Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 24th, 1998. In the Creekside room this afternoon is Al Trost. Session number is 98-9 and is titled Global Security versus National Security, The View from the U.S. Let's listen in.
I'm Al Trost. This is my last hurrah, so to speak, here. I've been here for 2 weeks and been talking about first week the influence of religion on several political systems. Actually, the one that I do most of my research in is Ireland. So I did that the first day, and then got into more and more unfamiliar territory as the week went on. And this week I'm doing global issues because of the Jubilee celebration yesterday. I was talking about different forms of enslavement and oppression and inequities in the world this week. And so this is kind of a wrap up today, more of the second week than of the first week. And I'd like to talk about the kind of conflicting points of view about whether we should be more concerned about global security or national security. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about how both people who do political science and economics and then people in the government, diplomats, have looked at the world at least through the end of the Cold War. And that is what's sometimes called the realist perspective. And this is as old as the ancient classical political philosophers, but in modern times this perspective was articulated by Otto von Bismarck, the German Iron Chancellor in the Second Reich, and by Henry Kissinger, another kind of practitioner of a realist perspective. And what it basically means is that every decision maker in foreign policy around the world and all governments should try to maximize their country's power in the international system, and should never give up power, should at least maintain power or increase power. And the theorists in this area, and there weren't only practitioners, but there have been a lot of people in international relations especially who have articulated this point of view, who claim that if everybody does it, that is, seeks to maximize national self-interest defined in terms of power, the world will achieve a balance. And this balance of power will control conflict then in the world. And will bring peace on its own. And this idea was pretty much maintained through the most of the Cold War, although near the end, as the United States began to pull ahead of the Soviet Union in many areas of military power, military weaponry, and certainly in economics, a lot of people had to discard the old balance of power idea and look for other ways to explain what nations should be doing, especially. But there was a close correspondence between the academic community in this period and the practitioners of diplomacy and decision makers in national governments. There have always been some countries who do it better than others. France has perhaps been the ultimate practitioner of realpolitik, and as I mentioned, Bismarck in the Second Reich, and another kind of a skilled practitioner of this. Some places have done it less well. One name I will mention from the academic community here, longtime professor at the University of Chicago, is Hans Morgenthau, and Morgenthau is the one who put theory about all of this together. And he used to actually be disturbed whenever he would see movements toward international organization like the United Nations, or people start claiming that the world court was the answer to the world's problems or the world rule of law. He thought that this was misguided, this idealism. In fact, he thought it's what had caused the problems with the Third Reich and the accumulation of power in Europe, that people, British diplomats and French diplomats, had abandoned this idea of holding Germany in check through power and had gone after elusive dreams of some kind of international peace or international concert. So that approach governed that long, and you still find probably half the textbooks in international relations take this realist approach. The whole idea has been challenged more and more, though, by several things I'd like to talk about, because they lead to the consideration of another alternative than the alternative of national security defined in terms of power. One of these is the growth of what are known as non-state transnational actors. I heard somebody mentioning multinational corporations when it came in. That's one of them. One of the more recent issues of current history has got the whole issue is about the global economy and the trend toward globalization. And that this is not an ideologically based journal in any respect, and they got people from both sides here talking again about how the economy has eclipsed the idea of a nation state. And transnational corporations and multinational corporations are no longer paying any attention to national boundaries. They simply go after what they need. If they need resources, raw materials, they go wherever they have to go to get them. If they're looking for markets, they go wherever they have to go. And they pretty much discarded national interests. But there are others as well. I mean, one day last week I was talking about Islam and world politics. This would be another transnational ideology, if you will, a religion that, in fact, if Islam is followed, as it's talked about in the Sharia, the Islamic law, nation states aren't even seen as good entities. So all of this adds up to, again, a very, very strong challenge to the nation state. Another challenge has been of another ideology, and that is the ideology of self-determination and empowerment for the poor of the world. The other day when I was talking about another one of these global issues, somebody in the group that was in the room brought to my attention a protest movement against a treaty that actually Congress did turn down about a month and a half ago, called the Multilateral Agreement on Investment. Does anybody know about this? This was an attempt to regulate restrictions on transnational corporations. If, for instance, Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing goes into Costa Rica, they are encumbered there by many environmental laws. So the cost of doing business for 3M in Costa Rica is substantially more than across the border in Panama, for instance. And this agreement was supposed to regularize the environment in which transnational corporations operated. Well, she was very much against this. This is a real move toward globalization. You see that instead of using national laws, you set up an international regime or an international system of laws. And so this is her position. She's somebody here on the Wisconsin Coordinating Committee on the Nicaraguan investment policies. And what she was concerned about is that we would move to this and there would be no provisions made to help local communities. For instance, in Nicaragua, many of the local communities specify that if you're going to do business in their community, you have to use so much local labor, and you have to use so many local products, and so forth. Well, this thing would pretty much put the end to that kind of thing, and she has spent a good part of her life trying to empower these peasants in these small communities, trying to build them up, and this kind of global initiative that is moving to it toward a global perspective has pretty much threatened that kind of move. Well, it also threatens the national self-interest kind of thing, that is that kind of ideology, localization. And so that's been another threat. And that all goes with a kind of empowerment strategy. That's especially prevalent in the third world. Just one or two other things here. One of the things that's, again, much remarked on is interstate, that is between state war, is pretty much no longer a phenomenon in the world, right? I mean, it's, we could look, I guess, at Kosovo as a conflict between powers, but it actually is taking place all in what is left of the former Yugoslavia in Serbia, and so that's a civil war. So interstate wars have pretty much ended, and as a matter of fact, use of large weapons has pretty much come to an end, and we have low scale, or what is known in the military as low intensity conflict. People put a satchel bomb in an airport or on an airplane, acts of terrorism, acts of guerrilla warfare, and that. And these also are rarely done between two identifiable state enemies. It's usually some kind of liberation movement, sometimes within the country where the terrorism occurs, sometimes from someplace else, Palestinians, for instance, putting a bomb in New York City or something like that. So all of this has, again, destroyed this idea of the world as fixed on states. Transnational economy, I mentioned here before. There's also a mismatch between the ecological problems the world faces and the ability of any nation state to carry this out. And some people who are pushing for a global security use this as their main argument. Remember, that's now about, I guess, a dozen years ago that we recognized the danger of fluorocarbons to the ozone layer that protects us from sunlight. And when that seemed to have a lot of scientific evidence in back of it, I mean, the world rushed through pretty quickly, in that case, an international convention on CFCs. Some people believed it was too late, that it should have been done decades ago, that the hole is there, and a kind of natural expansion of the hole, and that we've already lost the time that we need to correct the problem. The whole thing is here that, you know, no nation state can do that. I mean, you know, this was over in Antarctica primarily, which is nobody's national territory in the world, needed to respond very quickly here. And so ecological problems, especially environmental problems, seem to suggest that nation state, a world of nation states, is no longer the right way to deal with these kinds of problems. Well, let me talk now a little bit about how we approach the problem of where, first of all, our security lies, and then I'd like to bring in a few other considerations, equity, justice, a few other small topics here, as we try to look at how the world should be ordered and what the priorities of the United States should be as we face the world. And two things I got here, these are not my own, I got them from books that take now, remembering the realist slant, a more idealistic slant. Most just by the title of this book, it's World Security. Most of the books in this area are national security, this one's world security. Here's another one, the real world order, that attempts to use, you know, kind of flashy reference to reality here, a real cult peak, and then it kind of subverts your thinking into global security after you read the book. But I've taken these, this one here, went through a series of policy pronouncements by candidates for election in democratic countries to see what kind of common themes there were. And then he tries to prioritize these. And the number one priority he found in at least the developed nations was that politicians could agree that we ought to be fighting for the survival of the human species, not just at a kind of minimal level of living, but at a reasonably healthy kind of condition. And so I don't think any of us disagree with that, right? We don't want to see the human species disappear. So that's a kind of consensual, by the way, these run down from things that everybody can agree with, and then you get farther down the list here, they become more problematic. The second one was that pretty much everybody agrees that there should be a reduction in the amount of killing and other extremely brutal treatment of human beings. Again, we don't like to see that happen, although the interesting thing is that the television shows it to us, and some people, I suppose, do develop a macabre interest in watching violence, real violence, but I think all of us would like to see wars, brutal torture, and that kind of thing end. A third kind of priority here was the provision of conditions for the healthy subsistence of all peoples. Again, this means a kind of basic standard of living for everybody in the world. He found that this was something that about 80% of the candidates in these developed states were for. It begins to drop off here now in terms of support. Protection of citizens' rights, by this time we're down to about 60%. And then preservation of cultural diversity. I'm not going to go any farther down the list here, but I got that far down to show that this is something that's even debatable in the United States, right? Whether we want to preserve cultural diversity or whether we want people to assimilate. This was the old way of approaching diversity in the United States, kind of assimilate to an American way of life. In most countries, this is a big controversial issue. Whether you allow communities to kind of maintain their norms, maintain their traditions, or whether you try to have them assimilated. The European countries are much stronger on this than we are. We're a nation of immigrants, and this is something that's more likely to be debated really in our country, where in European countries you have more homogeneity. The Germans, for instance, are much less tolerant of the idea of cultural diversity. The French, much less tolerant of cultural diversity. Well, if these are the priorities, how do you best achieve them? Can you do this in a world of nation states? Can the United States singly make much of a contribution here? This book says yes. What it calls for is a kind of internationalization of American policy. Right now, the United States gives about 0.3% of our gross national product in foreign aid. This book calls for 1%, and another 1% in direct private investment, so that 2% of the gross national product would go to third world countries. That would help, for instance, on the bringing people up to a certain level of subsistence. It argues for a decrease in the defense budget, which, as a matter of fact, as you probably know, has been going on anyway. I mean, we've benefited by the end of the Cold War. Almost annually now, the military size is being reduced in the United States. We pull out of weapons programs that were planned from the 1980s, cutting back numbers, sometimes cutting programs altogether, so that, again, this argues for more of that. And that's certainly one strategy that preserves, and that's why this book is the real world order. It still assumes some realistic approaches to the organization of the world. Now, a more radical approach is taken by this book, and that's really what I'd like to talk a little bit about and show you. Where some people's thinking is in this. This happens to come out of the Kroc Center for Peace Studies at Notre Dame, named after the McDonald hamburger founder, the widow gave millions and millions of dollars. Del Brazo, we're waiting for something like this to happen. We don't have these kinds of contacts. I'm sure there are other Lutheran philanthropies that will be beat us to the hands here that are really about the money. But anyway, because they do have that kind of money, they can bring in thinkers who actually tie the outlook for the world and what we should be doing to a very clear kind of moral system here, in this case, kind of Christian moral system. So I'd like to just kind of show you what that looks like, okay? And it's going to be radical. I handed out to you a diagram of the United Nations. I'm going to be referring to that as I go through here. This man's name is Johansson, and he just moved up to, I think, director of the Crop Center. He suggests that a principled stance in international relations would have five components. One, and I'll mention these very quickly and then I'll go back and talk about each one. The first is reciprocity. The second is equity. The third is sustainability. The fourth is democratization. And the fifth is demilitarization. reciprocity is a change in attitude that would be required on the part of the world's leaders and statespeople, such that we would not do to any nation what we would not have them do to us. So, you know, we wouldn't tolerate subversion of our political system, so we shouldn't be subverting other political systems. We don't want another country to bring into question the value of the American dollar, the currency, so we shouldn't do that to other countries. And his proposal for bringing this about is to set up an institution in which all the countries of the world would be represented according to their needs, what they need from the world in order to achieve a kind of minimal standard of living. So that would reverse the power of the United States. It would kind of turn it on its head. And the poorest countries of the world would get the most representation in the body. Pretty radical. The United Nations, which you have the organizational chart for, is based on the idea that every country in the world, regardless of its size, has one vote. And the United Nations cannot take any action unless everybody in the organization agrees. They can only move forward by consensus, or the other possibility, which some of you may remember from your grade school days in civics, is that the Security Council of the United Nations. The United Nations has two bodies, two main principal organs that deal with political matters: the General Assembly, in which every country is represented, and the Security Council, in which there are five permanent members, right, and 10 non-permanent members who come in on a rotating basis. Basically, regions get representation. So Latin America has two seats. Western Europe has two seats. Western Europe plus Canada and Australia have two seats. The former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe has one seat on the Security Council. And those regions caucus and then put forward one. Sometimes they can't agree, so they put forward two names. And in good United Nations fashion, they split the two-year terms when that happens. So a country will be on it 1 year and then be replaced by the country, the other country that got some votes. The Security Council, in order to move forward, needs 9 votes of the 15, and it has to include the 5 so-called permanent members of the UN, China, Russia, the United States, France, and the United Kingdom. So it needs 5 plus 4 in order to go ahead. You can see in that formula that the large nations happens to be the victors in World War II, the victorious powers, but they are absolutely essential and all of them must agree before we move forward. You may remember in the Persian Gulf War, which was a United Nations action, we were worried until the last minute about China's vote on that. We were worried that China would vote no, which is in a sense a veto, or is essentially a veto, and so therefore the United Nations could have done nothing. Well, that's about all the world has been able to accept so far in terms of guidance. This, the General Assembly, the other organ, can only move forward on those kinds of matters, on enforcement matters, on division of resource matters, if it has a consensus, which means all countries. And if you vote no, your country is not covered by it. But this preserves national sovereignty, national self-interest. The United Nations was constructed in an atmosphere of realism, of real quality. Okay. The second is equity. By this, Johansson means more justice and more equal opportunity for the world. Mentioned the figure, which I in fact talked about during this last week. There are about 1 billion people in the world who live below the United Nations standard for minimum standard of living, which means that they're not maintaining basic nutrition. That is, they'll die of some nutrition-related disease unless this is brought up to the standard. And they also have a standard for housing and that kind of thing. So there are about 1 billion out of 5.5 billion people, 6 billion people in the world are below this policy standard. So obviously Johansson wants to bring everybody up to a standard that's actually higher than the United Nations standard. That's what he calls for, that's what he says is our Christian obligation. So here's how he's going to do that. He wants there to be a world tax in which people would be taxed on their income, so a world income tax, where the United States, Japan, Western European countries would pay the largest share of this tax. In fact, 75% of the tax would be raised in Western Europe, Canada, the United States, and Japan. Right now, approximately $20 billion is available for this kind of thing in the world. About $12 billion comes from national sources, including the United States, and another $8 to $10 billion comes from the World Bank, from the International Monetary Fund. So what he's talking about here is a pool of money about 10 times the size of the pool of money. Now, he's talking about approximately $200 billion that would be available for bringing people in the third world up to this standard. And in order to bring this about, he realizes that all those institutions are not going to be effective because they operate on the principle of national sovereignty. So he's calling for a new body, which he's going to call the World Economic Council, which will have kind of equal representation of the rich and the poor on it, and they will then decide not on the size of the tax that he wants to set in place before the body ever gets going. But he is talking about here this group being the allocator of this money. And one of the things I handed out to you, is the rich nation, poor nation gap. This comes in all kinds of forms. I'm sure you've seen that before. There's a tremendous difference. Here's the other one. Tremendous difference between rich nations and poor nations. And what Johansson is talking about is bringing, again, more equity to that. Finally, he wants to reform the world's international institutions. He wants to change the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization. I don't know, they're on that list there, or on the United Nations chart, I believe. They're what are called specialized agencies of the United Nations. The six circles up here are the principal organs. And again, the Security Council and the General Assembly are the two most important. The Trusteeship Council is practically out of business. There's only one trusteeship left in the world, and that's the American trusteeship in the Marianas in the Pacific Ocean. Otherwise, all the other trusteeships are gone. But notice down underneath the secretariat, There's a long list of agencies there. These are called the specialized agencies of the UN. And they all operate with autonomous budgets. They don't get their money from the UN. They raise their money separately. And many people believe that they have been the most effective parts of the UN because they're focused on one task. For instance, the World Health Organization deals only with world health problems, and it's been successful in pretty much stamping out malaria and smallpox around the world. It's got all kinds of accomplishments to its credit because it focuses. And for that reason, countries are willing to support it. Countries aren't in arrears in their contributions to the World Health Organization. The same thing is true of the International Telegraphic Union, World Meteorological Organization, Universal Postal Union. Nobody would withhold money from the Universal Postal Union because our mail couldn't move between countries if that happened. So those are all pretty much enthusiastically endorsed. Well, in that list is the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. These two agencies are a little different than the others in that they're the only place in the United Nations system where votes are awarded strictly on the basis of contribution. So the more money a country gives, the more say it has in giving it out. So the United States, historically, that is up until the middle of the Nixon administration, gave 40% of the money to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. So we got 40% of the votes. Right now we're giving about 25% of the total of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. So we have a quarter of the votes. So the United States uses that to enforce a kind of our idea of financial responsibility on the countries to whom the money is given. I mentioned this a couple days earlier this week. This is what's known as their policy of structural adjustment. They want countries, when they receive money, to have a balanced budget, a balanced trade picture. So they want them to cut back on expensive imports into their country. So, you know, it's kind of like the bank wanting to see evidence of your financial responsibility before they give you money. And that's enforced because the United States has the majority of votes. Well, that's why Johansson wants to remove this, because what that does is to require countries to, in fact, from Johansson's point of view, impoverish themselves before they can receive money. You know, by cutting back, for instance, they're going to cut back their budget to balance it. They'll cut back on health services, on educational services, and so forth. So, that's pretty radical again. You know, there's not a lot of support in the United States anyway for that, and to move in that direction is pretty tough. The third one is something that, you know, again, if you read publications of the United Nations and environmental groups and so forth, you see this word a lot. This is sustainability. This means that we have to make an effort. We have to be in back of the principle of sustaining the ecological systems in the world. We can't do anything further to damage these. In fact, we have to bring some of them back to a condition more like they were several hundred years ago. For this, he's calling for another international organization that would be part of the United Nations system, which he calls an environmental council. But here, he's got an idea. Again, if you look down the list of specialized agencies, one of them is called the International Labor Organization. This is one of the oldest specialized agencies. It predates the UN, came on under the League of Nations, and it's got a different representation. The International Labor Organization has one-third of its votes given to governments, the governments of the world. One-third of its votes are given to businesses. One-third of its votes are given to labor organizations. So the AFL-CIO has a delegation in Geneva, Switzerland, that goes to meetings of the International Labor Organization and promotes the American labor voice in that organization. That's the only one like that. Every other one has representation only from governments. But that one has tripartite, the tripartite representation. Well, his idea for this environmental council is to give one-third of the votes to the cut governments, one-third of the votes to industries, and one-third of the votes to citizens' organizations, citizens' environmental organizations, like Sierra Club. And they would then determine what a sustainable ecological system is, what the standard for that is, and they would then enforce that around the world. The fourth principle is democratization. Most of you know what that means, but he's got a kind of unusual take on this. He's talking about horizontal and vertical responsibility. That the United States, as a political system, would not only be responsible to its own citizens, I think we probably meet that standard. Half the countries in the world don't, but there are about half of them that meet that standard, where the government is actually elected by the people. But he's also talking about accountability to the other countries of the world. So that the United States, when it would promote a policy, especially one that had, again, global implications or consequences, that we would have to go before some kind of global body and get this approved, much like the government now has to go before Congress to get the policy approved. And in order to bring this about, he's got a couple, again, fairly, again, radical in the sense that they go way beyond what we do right now. He wants to, first of all, set up an international election commission like we have them in the States right now, you know, that would judge the fairness of an election and register voters in that. And he actually proposed Jimmy Carter to head this up because Jimmy Carter's made a career of going around and supervising elections, right? He's in El Salvador and all over the place supervising elections. He also wants a UN commissioner for human rights, somebody similar to the person that has responsibility for refugees and immigration around the world. He wants a comparable position to supervise whether human rights are being protected or taken away. And then the third one, and this is perhaps there are two more. He wants a people's assembly. The General Assembly of the United Nations represents nation states again. You know, Mrs. Kirkpatrick was there before, right? And then President Secretary of State was our representative for a while. Well, he doesn't want that kind of assembly. He wants an assembly that's directly elected by the people of the world. So the world would be divided up into constituencies, and we would elect a representative that would bypass our government and be part of what he calls this a people's assembly. And they would be then the place where the policies of nation states could be tested and checked in terms of their acceptance by the world community. We have something like that. I don't know how much attention you pay to Europe, but the European Parliament now is elected that way. It was initially elected by the parliaments of the various countries in the European Union, but now it's elected by constituencies throughout Europe. So, you know, 12 of the representatives come from Irish constituencies, and they bypass the Irish government. They go right to Strasbourg, right to Luxembourg, in order to carry out their representatives. Well, that's the kind of thing he's promoting. And then finally, and this is nothing new in these kinds of schemes, he wants an international police force, because obviously almost everything he said before is not going to be worth anything unless somebody's going to carry it out, right, going to implement it. And so far this, he's talking about an international police force that would be recruited directly by some international organization. Right now, as you probably know, when a peacekeeping force or an international police force is put together, the Secretary General of the United Nations got to get on the phone and try to scare up, you know, 50,000 troops are needed in Bosnia. He's got to call up the American government, he's got to call up the French government, he's got to call up a number of third world governments, he's got to call up governments from around the area, because the idea is they'll be more accepted in the trouble spot And so the idea here is to recruit an international police force directly without going through the governments. So that's what would be necessary in order to bring off this.
Would that police force be permanent, or would it be a temporary like it is now?
No, it would be permanent. It would be permanent. And I should say, backed up by an international military force, peacekeeping force then, that would have units in the national states designated for service in peacekeeping forces. There are two countries that do that right now. Canada does it, has done it since the 1960s. There are Canadian units that are specifically designated, even when they're not needed, for service in an international peacekeeping force. And the other country, which just started to do that about 3 years ago, was France. So they actually train people in that kind of thing. It's a different kind of military training than you get in the American military, for instance, where people are trained primarily in the management of force in defense, that is, in keeping an army away. This kind of army would have to be trained in all kinds of interpersonal skills, right? You've seen enough pictures on television, American troops and peacekeeping forces in Haiti and so forth, to know that there's a lot of different kinds of provocation. Rarely do they get shot at. It's more likely to be the case that they have to intervene between two hostile forces, and they may take rocks being thrown at them or people in their face arguing with them, and so it's a completely kind of different kind of setup. Well, the fifth proposal is for demilitarization. That's what it sounds like. He wants to decrease the role of the military in societies generally around the world, and he wants to gradually bring down the size of military forces. He thinks this is possible because some countries have already done it. Costa Rica has no army. Iceland has no army. So there are countries that have done without it, and not very big ones. And if you notice, Iceland is pretty much protected by water, and so, you know, it's not the typical kind of nation state. But in any case, he wants to decrease the role of the military. He wants to develop a reliable monitoring situations on arms control, where we would actually be, the Secretary General would be able to, the Secretary General of the UN would be able to send people in without getting the permission of the nation state to check on violations of arms agreements. Just a couple more things there, and then we'll have the plan laid out. He wants to make the Security Council more representative of the world. This has been a proposal that's independent of the proposal from the Notre Dame Peace Institute. A lot of people have proposed that, at the very least, the Security Council needs to better reflect now power in the world, which is no longer singly or only military power. I mean, when we talk about somebody challenging our power, I would say that we probably mention Japan as much as any country, and Japan has a very small military force. They're prohibited by their constitution from having a large military force. So that's economic power, and the idea here is that Japan ought to have a role in the Security Council because it has the second largest economy in the world, if one treats the European economy as separate economies. In fact, if you look at it from some angles, Japan's economy is larger than the United States economy. So if we have a veto, shouldn't Japan have a veto? And if Japan has a veto, shouldn't Germany have a veto? Because Germany is now a larger economy than France is. And if we give those countries vetoes, how about the largest power in Asia outside of China, which is India? How about the largest power in South America, which is Brazil? Well, you're expanding the size of the Security Council, and you're also giving more countries kind of final voice in that. But that kind of proposal, again, is around quite a bit. And then finally, the last thing here is giving the World Court of real power. The International Court of Justice in The Hague has been a body that has been around actually since 1919, has had a different name for a while, but it rules on international disputes. It's got a couple problems, however. One is that, again, recognizing a world of national sovereignties, a country can, from the very beginning, decide that it does not want to accept the jurisdiction of the World Court. You have to sign the statute of the World Court in order to be bound by its decisions. The United States is a country, of one of about 49 countries that have signed that statute, but we signed it in 1948, and we attached something called the Conley Reservation, which says that nothing in our adherence to the World Court shall in any way undermine the power of the United States Congress to regulate the foreign policy of the United States. So that the Congress of the United States, the Conley Reservation says, makes the final judgment on whether we are in fact bound by the World Court in this decision, which the American Congress has done once, to decide that we are bound by it, and that was in a dispute over the course of the Rio Grande River. The Congress, the most recent case was the United States versus Nicaragua. Remember, we mined a harbor in Nicaragua during the height of the Sandinista regime. This case was brought to the World Court. The World Court ruled in favor of Nicaragua. The United States said we don't accept the jurisdiction of the court in this case, and of course nothing happened. We were embarrassed, but nothing happened. Well, again, what Johansson wants to do is make this a court with real power, have this international police force be like the sheriff's office in serving subpoenas and serving bench warrants and so forth on people. And that's his idea for bringing about, again, reciprocity, equity, sustainability, democratization, and demilitarization. This is short of world government, by the way. This still preserves, you know, a layer of government at the national level. But what it's done is not made that any longer the place that can veto moves toward these five principles of a principle foreign policy. Now, the question is, and you know, I don't have the answer to this. So much of this I tell students in my class, a lot of this depends upon, first of all, you know, what your view of human nature is to start with. You know, if you're optimistic, if you think, you know, human nature is perfectible and that kind of thing, you're more likely to go along with something like the Kroc Peace Center proposal here. If you're totally down on human nature, believe with Hobbes that humans are brutish, nasty, selfish, then, you know, this is where the Morgenthau, Bismarck kind of idea got started. Well, Machiavelli had it long before them. They did, and actually some of the classical political philosophers had it before Machiavelli had it, so it's not a new idea. And, I mean, it depends also on, you know, your willingness to accept checks by people other than Americans on what the United States is doing. The problem is, again, that, you know, this whole idea of a state-centered world and national security is overriding consideration has been shown in enough cases not to be responsive enough. And I think, again, in the environment, we have the best case, but also just in responding to the world's inequities, we have another place where the system that we have is not working very well.
Do you think that Kroc Commission would have come to a conclusion that was different than the benefactor wanted them to come to? Happen to know Mrs. Kroc, kind of like led by organizations for contributing?
Well, probably wouldn't agree with all of this. I doubt if, you know, she looks at all the products that come out of the, or would have looked at all the products that come out of the Peace Center. I think that probably the donor did want a kind of, you know, a moral approach to politics to flow out of Christian faith, Catholicism specifically in this case. And that body has done, Mark back there knows a bit of its work as well. They've done a lot of other things. They're very big into conflict resolution processes, where they have worked on how to bring about peaceful settlement of disputes by using mediators and arbitrators and that kind of thing. So they do other things than this too. And I think, this is why, those of us who have to raise money for institutions, we always face this problem. And donors want to specify, to a certain extent, some policy outcomes, but you can't, at a university, you can't infringe upon, I suppose, the freedom of scholars to inquire. I mean, from one standpoint, there's no weight at all. Although there were four, and you'd have to follow international politics pretty minutely, but there have been four commissions set up by the United Nations that have recommended about the same thing. There was a commission under Willy Brandt, remember him, the old German chancellor who was asked to look at whether the North-South gap was going to be possible to overcome, and he made a report in the 1980s that called for a much more powerful United Nations. Olof Palme, the old Swedish prime minister who was assassinated, led a commission that made a similar proposal in 1983. Gro Brundtland, the woman Labour Norwegian prime minister, led another commission in 1987 that recommended this kind of thing. And let's see, who led the latest one? There was one that reported in 1990. Oh, Julius Nyerere, the old Tanzanian president, led another one. And they came out with fairly radical proposals as well. Now, their proposals has about as much weight as any recommendation to the United Nations has, which is that it gets some publicity, but then it doesn't mean I must say, to make it kind of personal, I'm near the end here, so, I don't, I'm not trying to maintain a big mantle of objectivity at this stage of the game. I will say that, I started out as a real strong kind of realist in approaching international relations, and I used to write some articles that I'm probably a little bit embarrassed by now. I guess I have come to the conclusion that a world of nation states probably is not going to fix some of the problems in the world, some that really threaten our security again. I think environmental pollution, some kinds of it, does threaten human race, to be drastic about this. There was this Club of Rome report that came out in the 70s. It predicted the end of renewable resources a little too quickly, but yes. Those trends are still going on. It's just that they're where they hit the horizontal axis is much farther out in the future than we once thought. But that it's the idea of non-renewable resources is still.
How does Johansson figure out how to deal with people like George Soros and Nike and things that can, George Soros can go into Asia and screw up the economies in Thailand with his hedge betting and go into London and, play around with the pound. I don't hear anything Johansson that deals with those kinds of people.
See, I think that this is where, if we look at realism as kind of where the mainstream was, you have kind of two more radical ideas on either extreme. The one is a globalist fix to this whole problem. And I think that that's probably where the Peace Institute people would come out. They'd want to regulate this by an international convention. You can regulate international finance, international business by conventions. I mean, we've done it, again, in the manufacture of chlorofluorocarbons, for instance. The problem with that is that you remove then the decision-making so far from where the people are that you then have kind of democracy problems at another level. And, I mean, the kind of opposite radical approach is the one of, you know, local solutions to global problems. You worry about the community that you're in and try to bring justice and equity in that community. And I think, again, the Nicaragua group that has been around the community here, that's their approach of where you can see your effects much better. The problem is then you're still living in, you know, a world of these other things happening, and they threaten this kind of approach. Yes?
The one problem I have is thinking about China human rights. It's like they're woefully stuck in with communism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right now we deal with human rights by countries. And some countries take a very strong stand on China's human rights violations. But the question is, what can one national government, one national sovereignty do to another? And the biggest national sovereignties haven't done much about China, because again, I mean, we look at China from the standpoint again of national self-interest. We see a big market there, so we're hesitant, and this is our president and our Congress right now, they're hesitant to do anything to China because, you know, we see 1.2 million people there. We're going to buy a lot of American products if the economy continues to grow like it's been growing. So we see that happening. We also wonder whether anything we do will actually help the people there. What this proposal is talking about is, well, the world community would unite because it would have the machinery to do that and could deal more effectively with human rights in China. Our way of doing it right now is for countries to take individual action.
On the other hand, that international human rights thing might take China's stance, whereas saying the right to, you know, food, clothing, shelter is more important than liberty and justice, and they might apply that to the United States and say, all right, well, you have to tighten up your, you know, control and freedom of speech and ensure that everyone has the same income, you know.
Yes.
What do they consider to be the most important human right? You know,
that's right.
What model do you follow? So I was going to ask a question. I guess maybe repeating Adam's question, that is, with the Kroc Peace Center's proposals, it was mostly, again, nation states. You know, the nation states, or going around it to the individual people. But still, I didn't hear mention of the existing international organization, like the economic thing. That maybe it's more the realist point of view. But multinational corporations, would they have any say? I mean, it seems to me that until you involve them, the control of the world economy, all the international organizations of the world aren't going to really do anything. You know?
Yeah. Well, there's no proposal except in the Environmental Council for representation of those groups.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with John Cobb? And I don't know if it's Daly or Dally, former World Bank economist, their book, For the Common Good?
I have not read that. I have seen it.
Okay, I just wonder how they fit into this.
Because
they have some pretty radical proposals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know that one. Generally, the most radical proposal comes out of United World Federalists. I mean, this is a group that's never been real strong. But they have little branches around up here in Washington and Oregon. You know, they're visible. Group anyway. They stand for creation of a kind of global federal state that would actually have a parliament. It wouldn't have a very strong executive, but it would have a strong parliament, it would have a strong court, and it would have a police force, international police force. And that tends to be, you know, on that end, on the globalist end, the most radical proposal. And at the other end, you have total local self-determination, you know, where neighborhoods kind of take over their own. We live in a world of interdependence. That's one of the things that's brought the whole realist model of the question. You know, again, you know, multinational corporations, how they relate to nation states. I mean, I have to have cooperation by some of these non-state forces, and so. Yes.
I think the average person in the U.S. today is pretty disenchanted with the UN. Of course, we don't know all that goes on there. Like you say, a lot of these organizations that do a lot of good, but for the General Assembly and the Security Council, it seems like they're just bogged down most of the time.
Yeah. And it's interesting that the proposal out of the Kroc Center and also this the other one here, the Singer Wildowski one. Neither one really talks about doing too much to the United Nations. I mean,
yeah.
They kind of have given up on that as an effective way of organizing the world. But the United Nations, it does. This whole approach using specialized agencies is called functionalism. Mm-hmm. And we use it, we don't realize it, but that same strategy is used in American politics when we create a special district to, you know, move sewage. For instance, or create a park district. This is the same kind of idea where you take it away from the general government and you give it to a specialized unit. And what we have found, and this shows what's called the functionalist logic to be a good logic, mm-hmm. is that these groups have a far higher standing in American politics than, you know, the Seattle city government has, or the Portland city government, or the Washington state government. The Chicago Park District, you know, around me, and the Water Reclamation District. I mean, they move the sewage and they move the water. People turn on their faucet. Occasionally it's brown, but, it mainly works, And in fact, this was such a strong movement that if you, for my master's thesis, I actually studied the Metropolitan Sewer District in St. Louis, and they have a kind of catch-all phrase at the end which says that a vote of the participating population can expand the function of the Metropolitan Sewer District into any area that, you know, and for cities, one of the problems that they've had is that they got so many municipalities. You know, I don't know exactly what the Seattle situation is out here, but Chicago, you know, has these hundreds of metropolitan governments. Mm-hmm. around. And this is a way to maybe create one government eventually. And that's what the functionalists had in mind in the creation of these specialized agencies. There are actually people who think like that mm-hmm. and see this as the road to take.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, time for a